Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. Somehow. Today, I'm very excited to have actor, producer, director Roxanne Dawson here with me. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi. How are you?
Quite well. For those of you who are not as familiar with Roxanne's work, please let me give you an introduction. A native of Los Angeles, Dawson graduated from UC Berkeley as a theater arts major. She got her first job playing Diana Morales in the Broadway production of A Chorus Line. That's a big... While in New York, Dawson also performed in numerous off-Broadway and regional theater productions, including plays at Circle Repertory Theater, Arena Stage, and at CTC, where she played Miranda in Julie Taymor's The Tempest. A series regular role in Aaron Spelling's Nightingales brought her back to L.A., but she was honored to be asked to return to Broadway to close A Chorus Line as the last Morales, which is quite a nice honor. She was then cast as B'Elanna Torres in Star Trek Voyager, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners definitely know. And during the series' seven-year run, she started a family and began her directing career. Voyager offered her the first opportunity to direct, and then she proceeded to direct 10 episodes of the next Star Trek series, Enterprise. That's a really great way to get started. We'll talk about that, too. Since then, she's directed The Deuce, House of Cards, The Americans, The Path, Bates Motel, Chance, and Tremé, and will direct Morning Show, starring Reese Witherspoon, Steve Carell, and Jennifer Aniston. Dawson has been the producer-director on the perennial hit Scandal, as well as Cold Case and Crossing Jordan. I loved Crossing Jordan.
That was good.
We'll talk about it. Other credits include The Chi, Marvel's Runaways, Lost, The Good Wife, and Hell on Wheels. Dawson recently directed the pilot and first two episodes of Mercy Street for PBS and Scott Free Productions. Mercy Street marked the first American drama to air on PBS in more than a decade. Roxanne also co-authored a trilogy of novels with Daniel Graham called the Tenebrae Trilogy, published by Simon & Schuster. She makes her feature film directing debut, however, with Breakthrough, based on the incredible true story of one mother's unfaltering love in the face of impossible odds, an adaptation of Joyce Smith's memoir, The Impossible, the miraculous story of a mother's faith and her child's resurrection. The movie is going to be released by Fox 2000, is probably one of their last releases.
One of the last, yes.
Oh, my God. I'm still so sad about Fox 2000.
I know. No.
When I saw that they weren't making that jump, we digress.
That was a tragedy. Yeah, that really was. In that move, I thought they were safe, but no. That was really sad.
You never know. Sometimes quality just doesn't make
the cut.
It
just doesn't translate. I don't know.
Okay, so all that said, the movie that you've chose to talk about today is the original The Bad Seed.
The 1956 version of The Bad Seed, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose this movie? Why is this one of your fave genre films?
Well, I saw it as a child, and it affected me so strongly. I mean, I couldn't sleep for a week after it, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It was... and then I saw it several times as a child when it would repeat, like on Saturday and Sunday when they would show all the old movies.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Those were the best.
Oh, so good. And then I had children, and I decided to sit them down when they were about 7 and 8, and my husband thought, okay, you're going to have to put them into therapy now. I said, listen, I dealt with it. They're strong enough. They can deal with it. And they actually loved it. My little one got a little bit scared, but they loved it as well. And it's just really held up. I looked at it again when I knew I was coming to see you just last week. Went and looked at it again, and it's really held up. It's beautiful. I mean, I think one of the reasons I also chose it was because the cast is mostly from the Broadway play, which actually had a different ending.
And we'll definitely get into
that's
and
very
those choices
interesting.
For sure.
Yeah, and I thought that the actors were so well honed into their characters, and that really came, I think, from doing this over and over again. It also was done in a style that was a little bit more, like theater, almost like you were stepping into a theatrical production, which didn't bother me because I feel that the story itself is a little bit elevated and requires a certain suspension of disbelief, you know. And I think that just sort of kept you in that world and in the style of acting and and the characters, the way they approached their roles. So, but I just thought it held up so well. I was riveted even watching it last week.
In agreement. And for those of you who haven't seen the original Bad Seed from 1956, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch The Bad Seed, I highly recommend, please do it now. Let's introduce The Bad Seed, a little synopsis. Written by John Lee Mahan and directed by Mervyn LeRoy, The Bad Seed stars Patty McCormick as Rhoda Penmark, an obnoxiously perfect little girl. Rhoda's father, Kenneth, takes leave for military duty, with only mother, Christine, to care for Rhoda. Landlord and busybody neighbor, Monica Breedlove, which is such a great name, immediately gives Rhoda some gifts, including some sunglasses and an heirloom locket necklace. It's clear Rhoda is used to being lavished with possessions and attention, though she is quite sore at losing the penmanship medal to a classmate, Claude Daigle.
It's the only gold medal Miss Fern gives, and it was really mine. Everybody knew I wrote the best hand. And I should have had it.
Rhoda.
I just don't see how Claude Daigle got the medal.
Rhoda, Rhoda, these things happen to us all the time.
Christine takes Rhoda to her school's picnic and goes home. Later, Christine's having lunch with Monica and two friends, and they hear that Claude drowned at the picnic. Rhoda comes home and moves on like no big deal.
I want you to try to get these pictures right out of your mind. I don't want you to be worried or frightened one little bit. These things happen to us sometimes, and when they do, we simply accept them.
Oh, but I thought it was exciting. Can I have the peanut butter sandwich?
But Rhoda's teacher comes by and is like, I'm not going to say your daughter killed that boy, but I am also saying maybe she killed that boy, and please don't bring her back here.
It would be as well to make up our minds now that she will not be there.
Well, then there is some shadow over, and you've already decided not to invite her back.
Yes, we have made that decision.
And you can't tell me why.
I think her behavior in the matter of the medal would be sufficient explanation. She has no sense of fair play. She's a poor loser. She doesn't play the
Surely
game.
Surely you're not saying that Rhoda had anything to do with the Daigle boy's death.
Of course not.
It's a big, confusing convo with a lot of cryptic double talk. And then Mr. and Mrs. Daigle interrupt. Hortense Daigle is totally drunk and wants to know if, since Rhoda was the last one to see Claude alive, if she knows what happened to that penmanship medal that was pinned to his shirt.
And where's the medal? Who took the medal?
I have a right to know what happened to the penmanship medal. If I knew, I'd have a pretty good idea what happened to him.
This is partly exploratory, partly accusatory. Christine finds the penmanship medal later on in Rhoda's treasure box, then talks to her dad and discovers she's actually the daughter of a notorious female serial killer.
Oh, Daddy, you've kept this from me all these years. I came out of that terrible household. That's where you found me.
The neighbors found you after your mother disappeared. I discovered you with them before anybody. The most astonishingly sweet and beautiful little thing with the most enchanting smile I have ever seen. As Tasker said, I was there covering the case for a Chicago newspaper. I wired my wife and she joined me. We couldn't resist
Daddy.
You.
Later, she catches Rhoda trying to burn her favorite tap shoes, and Christine lets her do it, choosing to support her murderous daughter. LeRoy, the gardener, teases Rhoda about knowing she killed the boy.
You didn't hit that little boy with no stick. You hit him with them shoes. Ain't I right this time?
You're silly.
Rhoda later sets LeRoy's bed on fire, and he burns to death in front of Christine's eyes as Rhoda practices piano. Christine tries to kill her daughter with sleeping pills and then shoots herself in the head. At the hospital, however, we find that Monica found Rhoda just in time for her stomach to get pumped, but Christine is in a coma. Rhoda goes home with her dad, but sneaks out at night to try to fish out the metal taps from her shoes because her mother said that she put them back at the scene of the crime. Christine wakes and calls her husband. Rhoda is suddenly electrocuted and blown up by a random bolt of lightning. No, seriously, that's the end.
that's what happens. So not much happens in this, right?
It's like,
Like, what? Try pitching that now. You know what I mean? This is what I want to do film about, you know?
Yes, exactly. And I'm like, okay. And then, wait, what?
Yeah.
And yet, you know, it is all like you buy it. And, you know, you hit on something that I would love to talk about first. And that is something about deciding to do the play in this one space and keeping it mm-hmm. in a contained place. Mm-hmm. Because sticking to the original Anderson play, he worked with cinematographer Harold Rawson, and he opened up the film primarily by moving the camera around the room. But you're really mostly in one room, except mm-hmm. for like you step out to like the boathouse a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're in the hospital for a little bit. But the choice really ended up kind of paying off because it visually isolates and traps Christine as she's figuring this out. Because even though this is about Rhoda, this is mm-hmm. actually about Christine kind of finding out that her yes. daughter is like this.
Yes, yes. It's Christine's journey, really.
Yeah.
I mean, finding out about her daughter, finding out about her past.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really is her journey. But, you know, this was I think the budget for this was $1 million and it was nominated, for four Academy Awards? When was the last time that $1 million movie was nominated? Granted, it was 1956.
Yeah, I don't even know what inflation was, but still.
Yeah, still, you know, and it was very contained. I know there was another version of this done in the 80s. I saw a snippet of it, and the snippet was of Leroy actually burning, and that's the only thing that I've seen.
Yeah.
And you don't see that in the 1956 version. It's left to the imagination. All the killings, I mean, you don't see a killing happening. Even the mother shooting herself happens down the hall.
Yep.
You know, it's just you don't – behind a closed door. So you don't see any of this, but your imagination, I mean, you go – why would this be so scary, especially to audiences today that are so used to seeing everything and having it kind of like shoved in their faces?
Yep.
But yeah, my daughters were completely riveted by this. And it's because it's very true. We have to remember that the imagination can take us so much deeper than actually having to see everything.
Yeah.
Just hearing Leroy's cries down there, you know, and people rushing to him, you know, it's just,
yep.
it was like, you know, it was just horrible.
In a way, you know, something about that little section where you kind of get these characters looking out the window in this apartment courtyard. It mm-hmm. really, it kind of reminded me of Rear Window in a sense, you mm-hmm. know, like this kind of Hitchcock idea where
yes.
you don't necessarily have to see things, but just the idea that it's out there and it's so close. And
right.
It's,
right.
And it's also so close inside your house.
Yeah.
You know, you're definitely trapped.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I never found the film claustrophobic. I mean, it's probably, and even when I saw it when I was younger, I actually didn't know that it came from a stage play. I just, it just felt right to me. So mm-hmm. I think either the camera movement, the blocking, everything about it really didn't let you feel claustrophobic at all.
I think, okay, so I want to talk about, I mean, we'll be talking about Rhoda quite a bit, but I want to talk about the fact that Rhoda as a character was something that we really had not seen before. This is like around a decade away from Children of the Damned.
Mm-hmm.
And it's around maybe two decades away from The Omen,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so it's...
Now, we hadn't seen an evil child before.
No.
No. And it was so jarring to the audiences that at the very end, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, I mean, you have that moment where the actors come out onto the stage and Nancy Kelly takes yeah. Rhoda, Patty McCormick, over her lap and spanks her, and
yeah.
you see that they're actually alive and okay and
mm-hmm.
and that they're friends. And it's almost like the audience had to be reminded in this kind of a curtain call for the film
yes.
that they're okay, because it was so haunting. And I know at that time for the studios, if we can discuss the fact that they had two different endings for the play, the book, and the movie,
yep.
is that at that time at the studios, there was, I don't even know if it was a written rule or what, but they couldn't have evil that was not answered, that there wasn't a just ending. And in the play and the book, Rhoda lives and her mother dies.
Yep.
And that...
Which seems like the natural ending from
it does.
How it's set up. So
yeah,
it's like, oh...
It does. You know, and so... But instead, in this film, we have that that kind of godlike lightning bolt that takes Rhoda out at the very end and basically deals with the evil so that it's a satisfying ending for the audiences, and the studio would allow it to happen that way, but yeah. only that way.
And I understand that to an extent. I mean, this was such a new thing for audiences. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to alienate them. And I think audiences could imagine what the ending was supposed to be. You know, yeah. I hope it wasn't too much of a letdown. But I like, you know, I like the idea that we also, like audience, we crave a kind of just morality mm-hmm. in our entertainment. And I'm thinking about that even in terms of like the movie that you've just directed, mm-hmm. Breakthrough, where you feel like there might be some kind of just thing for people who are going mm-hmm. through something terrible, that, mm-hmm. like someone will step in, something a higher power steps in, mm-hmm. and sets things right.
We want to believe that there's some kind of moral compass, and that the people who are evil in the world get their just desserts, and then the people that are good get rewarded. There's a part of us from childhood that wants to believe in justice, mm-hmm. and it doesn't always happen, but we cling to that. Which is not bad. I think we should.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to media, I think that we need equal portions of like that justice actually coming mm-hmm. for us, and then another set of reality that's like, it may not be here. Mm-hmm. I do like thinking about your movie Breakthrough as kind of like the exact opposite sided like coin of the bad seed.
Evil child, good child.
Right? Yeah. We're just like, yeah. Show your child the bad seed and then show them breakthrough. And be like, you know, like if you're good and you're kind,
yeah, there'll be no lightning bolt in your future.
Maybe. But then there's also the reality of the bad seed. I want to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about censoring and then something that you hit on a little bit earlier too, which is the idea that these actors really, really honed in on who these characters were through doing the play on Broadway for so long. So we'll take one quick break and we'll come right back.
The Greatest Generation is the most popular Star Trek podcast in the world.
A pretty dubious distinction, but it's true. We've blasted through all of Star Trek The Next Generation, and now we are blasting through Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Come find out why millions of people have listened to our show and the Star Trek industrial complex ignores it.
Go to MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts and look for The Greatest Generation.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Roxanne Dawson, and we're talking about The Bad Seed.
Yes.
So on the break, you were saying something about maybe like in your career wishing that you could pitch something.
Well, I've always loved this story and have been very intrigued by the two different endings. And I was a producer-director on the show Cold Case,
yeah.
and which really at its core dealt with some of the things that we've just been discussing, our need for justice and wanting to know that the bad guys will, you know, will be found
yeah.
and that there'll be some sort of justice for the victims. And it was always ended in this montage, you know, where you go back and an old case is finally solved and
yep.
you feel like now whoever died in the process of that event was now, you know, resting in peace finally and the people around them. But anyway, it was I always wanted to pitch a story where maybe Rhoda, who would now be like Patty McCormick's age,
yeah.
you know, in her late 60s or early 70s, that they reopen the cases of the kids that she killed. And they have to come back to this woman who is in like a new life, and they start to interview people, and you end up finding out that she was the one that killed all of these people when she was younger, you know, and see how do you reconcile that? Maybe she had changed when she got older, or maybe she continued these murders mm-hmm. and maybe this all led back to those cases when she was a child. But also I think the interesting thing about The Bad Seed is it really it entertains the idea and the possibility of genetically passing on the, something, you know, a killer's mind or a killer's appetite.
Yep.
And that's something I think we always wonder when you have these amazing serial killers and they break apart their brains trying to figure out what's missing. Is there something in there that makes you have compassion that these people just don't have? What is that thing, you know, that allows people to be just pure, pure evil and have no compassion or feeling for the person that they're victimizing? So
that's something, I mean, okay, let's stop there for just a second, because the conversations that they have about nature versus nurture mm-hmm. were something so new for the culture
yes.
at that time. And mm-hmm. there's quite a lot of dialogue back and forth, because you have a criminologist who's
right.
there visiting mm-hmm. and you have Christine's father, who is who's been a renowned reporter on crime mm-hmm. and criminals, including the serial killer, a female serial killer. So mm-hmm. here's another, like, that's another
yeah.
thing, a female serial killer who is all smiles and kindness and the idea of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that was extremely shocking, the idea that someone really could just inherit something bad, you know, that's...
Yes, and so frightening, because you feel like it's nothing that you have control over, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, very much so. The idea that she could be born this way with no cure, and that she would be let out into the world as she got older to inflict her pain and damage on other people
mm-hmm.
is the reason that her mother very painfully decides to take her daughter's life, and then, of course, her own. But she obviously loves her daughter so much, but sees what her daughter is. And it's such a horrifying decision, probably next to Sophie's Choice, I can't imagine.
It is.
I mean, to choose to have to kill your child because that child is evil.
Yeah.
Is it's powerful.
A lot of this, like, so these discussions, you know, they're very long, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're very long, and they're pretty riveting, but it's not the kind of thing that you'd normally see in movies or mm-hmm. in TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, you know, like, as a director, if you saw something like this, let's say you got this material and you're like, oh, these are some big ideas that have to come out through discussions. I
mm-hmm.
mean, how do you attack something like that? Like, what, I mean, it just, I feel like most people just would not even do it anymore.
I love films that actually ignite a dialogue that should happen after the film. If that dialogue happens too much in the film, it leaves nothing for an audience to discuss afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a balance you have to find there when doing anything that has big ideas, because if you're just presenting the ideas, why not read them? In other words, they need to come out through characters that are ambiguous and cause the audience to discuss the right and the wrong, so that you're really dealing with the grays of the subject and not the black and the white.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, that becomes, those movies would be propaganda, or they would be preaching,
yeah.
or they would be, that's another
yeah.
kind of movie, and that exists and has a purpose. But it's not the kind of drama that I would want to tell. I really would like to be the starting point for a discussion that happens afterwards and not fully discuss it, unless it's one of my other favorite movies, which is My Dinner with Andre, which they just discuss it the entire time.
Yeah.
And that I love too.
Yeah. Text is the subtext is
yeah,
the text, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that was one of my, that was my first video that I ever bought, was that one. I truly just dated myself. But I truly love that film. But I love ideas and discussions, but I really love when they happen afterwards and not are bandied about in the film itself.
Yeah.
You know, that it comes from the characters and their interactions.
I'm curious. So you do have, so Breakthrough is, it is a kind of faith-based movie,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, you're dealing with this kind of possibility of that. So,
mm-hmm.
so how do you present that? Because I'm sure that, like, you still want to really reach audiences that are not, you know, necessarily.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah.
how do you approach something like that, where you're like, these are big ideas that you're putting into a movie, but.
Well, they're big ideas, but that's because that's the nature of the story. It's a true story
mm-hmm.
and is absolutely true. I've talked to all of the people involved. I spent time in St. Louis with the family. I've spoken with the doctors, people around. And basically, my job was to stay faithful to the story. That's why it's a drama above anything else. It's a drama. It's not, I mean, I know it has a faith-based...
like a premise?
Identity, but
yeah.
I mean... That's only because that's a part of the story.
Yeah.
It is for no other reason.
Yeah.
You know, and the story is fascinating and riveting. And when I first read the script, I immediately read it through twice and called my agent and said, I really want to be the one to tell the story. I know
oh, wow.
how to tell the story, you know. And so it was and then, of course, I went online and began to do some research into the real events. And they just it I think that when you're dealing with something that is true, then you just need to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. There's
and don't worry about the big ideas is what I mean. They're there. They're in there.
Well, a few people know the bad seed is true. I'm kidding, obviously.
I know. But, it made me think.
But you're like, maybe I know.
But I mean, true on some level. I mean, there are people like that.
Oh, God, yeah.
And they were children.
I was certainly watching that, and I was just like, oh, this reminds me of a politician that I know. I want to step back because we'll go back to the idea about theatrical actors working on this movie because it is a very unorthodox thing for the director to have Mervyn LeRoy to have chosen to actually work with the cast who made this play famous and award winning.
I know I read that Rosalind Russell was going to be offered the role, and then they finally decided to stick with Nancy Kelly, who was so brilliant in it.
Yeah, and Betty, I think Betty Davis lobbied for it, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
She was lobbying for it, too. So
it's a great role.
So it was a role that everyone was just like, oh, God, I really want this. But so the idea that they went with Nancy Kelly, I think, is really lovely. I think that there's parts of her performance that I can tell is from a theater background, and yet I kind of don't care when it comes to a movie like this because I appreciate a kind of melodramatic identity in movies like this. I don't find that as a dirty word. But the thing that I found obviously most fascinating is that Patty McCormick's, you know, she was cast when she was 8 years old. And I think when they made this film, you know, it had been already like a few years. I think she was like maybe 11 or something, 11, 12. And she has the most honed performance that you will ever see, I think, from a child actor. And I mean, I'm not like there's a lot of great child actors that have been around, you know, Kirsten Dunst when she did like Interview with a Vampire, very, very focused, very in her own self. There's lots of folks, but this one is so devastating. It is devastating. Yeah. I love it so much.
You kind of wonder if it did any damage to her. It's so devastating.
I mean,
as a person, because to play somebody that truly does not have a conscience and to understand what that could mean at that age, you go, oh my gosh, did therapy follow this? You know?
I don't know. It's a really funny thing. I heard there was a story that Mervyn LeRoy remembered asking Patty McCormick how she felt about playing, quote, a girl who kills people. And she responded apparently in a sing-song voice, oh, Mr. LeRoy, I'm having so much fun.
And oh my goodness.
So everyone who was around her on set was actually like, this is a grounded little girl who has a really deep understanding of what this is, knows how to set it aside. And she ended up, you know, she's ended up being a very successful character actor, you know, and she's got some thoughts on that we can cover as well.
I think if she didn't have fun doing this role at that age, then there would be something wrong with her because she'd be taking it to a place inside of her that wasn't right. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think the only way that a child, and she really was a child when she started this, could play a role like this is if they literally have to cut off parts of themselves from feeling. I mean, you really have to almost do what Rhoda did, you know, in order to just get there. They can't think about the implications of that. You know, she can't think about the fact that she killed the boy for the medal. She has to think, well, that's the way I get the medal.
Yeah.
That's how I get it. You know, it's just that's it, one step to the next. You know, if you start to think about that, then that's not who Rhoda is.
No. And I, you know, I also think that maybe her doing this in theater for so long, which is a very different environment for making things, very different people working in that environment. You know, maybe that allows her to be a little bit more grounded. She's also performing like for an audience and getting that feedback. She said, quote, if I did something one night and the audience responded favorably, I would keep it in the next performance provided the director approved. So the character evolved. And when it came time to film the movie, I was very comfortable with the character and my role, which that statement for an 8-year-old who was making that. You know, like who knew
I know
at that time.
A lot of college students that couldn't talk that well. So
you know, like it's a really
very insightful.
It's very and she just understood that that's what you do to get better and just liked the craft of acting.
Yeah, well, the craft of acting, which isn't as respected now, I think, as it used to be. I mean, Uta Hagen's book is one of my favorite respect for acting, and I had the fortune of being able to study with her in New York when I was there. And she was a savior, godsend to me. I really loved her. But she, you know, it's the kind of muscle that you have to work on to be able to do a show 8 times a week. Mm-hmm. You know, to know where that lies in your body as an actor. That kind of discipline allows you to repeat a performance over and over again. I mean, when we're doing film and television, I'm just grateful if I can get one. And then if I push it too far, if they've now gone to the other side, you know, it's passed. And it's so different than the muscles that you exercise as an actor, you know, on the stage, I mean. And a lot of that is lost. I mean, so that's why I don't think we have as much respect for acting these days as we should, because the people that really, like, when I worked with Chrissy Metz on Breakthrough, I also worked with her on This Is Us. I directed an episode of that as well. Mm-hmm. Two entirely different characters. She's a chameleon. And what she has to draw on for these two very, very different people, that's a craft. That's something she works on. That's something she studies, you know, and it'd be so wonderful if actors, as they're coming up in the world, really understood that it really is a craft that has to be honed.
Yeah. I wish everyone could start off in the theater. Like, you have to do, like, at least 5 years, put in 5 years of live theater.
I'm so grateful for my roots there. So grateful. I mean, it's a kind of discipline that is just not learned anywhere else.
Well, can we talk about, I want to get into the difference between acting for stage and acting for screen, because, you know, what I was saying earlier, Nancy Kelly, you know, the way that she's kind of like, I don't want to say chewing up the scenery because that sounds negative, but, you know, the way that she's like very physical and very, mm-hmm. you know, her body takes up the space in a way that you would expect a stage theater, a stage actress to do. Mm-hmm. And so I was, you know, wondering, because everything that you see about this is like, here's a quote that I found from something. Her bag of acting tricks is ready to burst, and she deploys them shamelessly in a rhapsody of hand-wringing, table-clawing, eye-rolling, whisper-to-scream hysterics that could be excised as individual lessons on acting no-nos. Like, that was a review, right?
Right.
So at the same time, though, I love it. I love the performance. It's something that I don't see on screen very often. So I'm like, oh.
I really did love it. And you don't see it. And then you go, well, how should a mother react when they realize their child is a murderer? You know?
Yeah, just blankly stare into space in stillness, you know?
I mean, there was definitely, she did take up the space, but I also thought she filled it, you know?
Yep.
And it's okay to take up the space if you're really filling it. I see those bags of tricks, if you want to call them, more maybe now, not when I was little when I watched this.
No.
And it seems like I just took that as a mother who truly loves this child who is killing people.
Yeah, what would you do if your child
killed? How do you react? I mean, is there anything that's too big? I mean, sometimes, you know, you can go just watching the news and you see a child that has died and a mother reacting on camera, you know, and the wailing and the grief and things that you can see sometimes. And they're rather... those moments are rather large in us, you know? And so I think it's I agree and disagree with that review.
I
think
there
are, there are definitely two sides to that.
Do you, when you're ever directing, do you ever wish that your actors would, like, go a little bit bigger, you know, like go against, like, the screen actor's, like, code of, like, keep it still, less is more, and just be like, I don't know, fucking go for it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes when an actor is a little bit lazy and they haven't made choices, they think that, oh, I'm just being small, you know, when actually, no, you're just being boring. So you want them to make choices. A lot of times, you know, I'll look at an actor who, let's say, doesn't have a lot of the lines, so he figures it's not his or her scene. And I'll ask them, well, what are you thinking through all this? What are you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And they have to say to me what they're thinking. I said, okay, I need you to think louder. Think louder. Because listening is something that it's a craft unto itself. And you know the actors that can really listen on the screen, and you can be in their eyes while somebody else is talking and see a complete transformation in them. And that's that is a strong thing to be able to do as an actor.
Yeah.
An asset.
It's reality that's not reality. I don't know. It's acting. I have such a respect for them. I do have a respect for actors.
good.
I really wanted to get into some stuff about Eileen Heckart, but maybe we'll say that for the last segment, because what I want to maybe say is that the lighting of Rhoda, something mm-hmm. that I was noticing this time as an mm-hmm. adult watching this, looking mm-hmm. at the craft of what's happening, mm-hmm. I was looking at the cinematography mm-hmm. and I absolutely enjoy the lighting on Rhoda because mm-hmm. it is almost angelic. Mm-hmm. It catches her blonde hair and these like shining, like bright blue eyes in this really interesting way, because one would think she would be lit in shadows, but it's actually her mother who's often lit in shadows and anguish. And Rhoda clearly doesn't feel any shame. So the light is kind of representative in a sense of shame or guilt. And she's lit to be the most powerful presence in the movie.
She's lit very flat.
Yeah.
You know, and her mother, you're right, is lit in shadows because she's the one who is ambiguous. Rhoda's not ambiguous.
Yeah.
She's completely who she is. She's not distraught. She might be distraught about being found, found out, but she's not distraught about anything that she's doing. Her mother is the one who's going through everything.
Yeah.
You know, but yes, you're completely right. She's lit very flat. You don't see, she's not in half light. She's not, you know, even when she's walking through the street at night, you know, she's got an inner light that's moving with her, you know, as she's heading through the rain, you know, it's
she's just like kind of like happily plodding through the rain. Like, I'm going to take my murder weapons back and I'm going to get rid of them and everything will be fine.
Yeah. She's got it solved.
I love these little techniques, though. Maybe that does also play into why people were so afraid of her, is that mm-hmm. the filmmakers, you know, chose not to show her as like the normal villain.
Mm-hmm.
A different
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you, I mean, you've had to portray your fair share of villains in mm-hmm. TV. Can you share the way that you try to approach them? Are like there ways where you feel like you have to circumvent what the villain looks like? Or,
well, a villain is never a villain in the villain's eyes.
That's true.
Right? Yeah. They're always justified. So you can't go there. You can't think that what you're doing is villainous. It's all justified. So when you see people who are bad actors, I don't mean a bad actor. I mean somebody who acts bad, as in a villain does.
Yeah.
They have to feel that they are in the right. When you see somebody who's obnoxious and you're judging them as being obnoxious as a character, they don't see themselves as being obnoxious. You know, they don't judge themselves the way you do. So we have to make sure, when I talk to actors about playing these types of characters, I remind them that you cannot judge the character you're playing. I mean, if you're playing Hitler, you can't say, oh, I'm a bad person. You know?
Yeah.
No, you're justified.
Yeah, you Hitler's
believe
not
in
weeping
what,
like, oh, I did a bad thing, you know?
Absolutely not. No, you believe that you're completely justified in what you're doing. And you have to throw yourself behind that mindset.
Even on Star Trek, you have to have a villain for every episode.
Yeah, there are villains on Star Trek. And what's interesting is on Star Trek, going through all of the different types of stories there are times where you might have a version of yourself that's a villain playing opposite you. You know, you don't – there's in sci-fi, you can go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so
– Did you play – like, what's the baddest that your character ever got when you were – is that hard for you to
no,
play that?
No, probably – but bad again. It's so.
I know.
It's such a. I know. But probably, I think there was an episode where B'Elanna was pregnant, and didn't. B'Elanna was a character that I played who was half human,
B'Elanna
half
Taurus.
Klingon. Mm-hmm. Klingon, and she was debating whether she wanted to change the DNA of her child because she didn't want the child to have any Klingon.
Oh.
And because she was so ashamed of that side of her. And she felt very justified because she was teased as a child and she didn't like to be this kind of half-breed. And so she wanted to save her daughter from that. So she thought that would be a good thing to sort of excise that out of her daughter's mm-hmm. DNA. You know, when actually, if you think about it, it's what makes B'Elanna such a great character, is this kind of war inside of her. And these two people allows her to be compassionate and see all different things. But yet she couldn't see it when it came to her own child. And so that was probably, I don't know if you want to call it evil, but you can in some ways, to go in and actually change the DNA of your soon-to-be born child so that it doesn't have certain feelings and think certain things.
I'm going to say that relates pretty quickly back to Christine.
Yes, it does, actually. Yeah.
Christine is not necessarily innocent in this. You know, she knows that she's guilty. The reason that Leroy dies is because she doesn't turn in her own daughter.
Yeah.
And it's just like she chooses this idea of what she thinks is right for her child.
And also because she's blaming herself. It was her genes passed through her to her child that is causing this.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into some Eileen Heckart because she's one of my favorites from this movie.
So good in this, too.
Yeah. All right. We'll be right back.
We've all made mistakes in book club, right? You drink a little too much. You don't actually read the book. And if you're under the bubble in Fairhaven, your individual will get subsumed by the collective.
Hey, maybe I just let him go and whip us up some guac.
We do not require guac. We require only nutrients and expansion. You will become book club. You will eat, pray, and love with us. Join book club.
Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Roxanne Dawson, and we are talking about The Bad Seed. Eileen Heckart. Okay, so she plays Mrs. Daigle.
Yes.
And her performance gives me life.
Ugh.
And I know people, like what we said, like people will say that she's chewing the scenery in a sense, but there's these moments of like quiet little fugue state things that happen to her. Mm-hmm. So she's going, you know, like from 0 to 100 to 50 to 100 to 0, just kind of back and forth.
Her craft is amazing. It truly is. And I have to say, too, one thing I was also aware of, there's amazing score that is playing behind her, too.
Oh, my God.
The score is so good and so original and so not milking it. It's supporting her performance without without pushing into it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, but man, she is, I felt like I knew what it was like to lose a child through her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, she's, it's one of those things where she's a drunk character, but at the same time.
So hard to do. So hard to do.
Tell me more about, because the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, you could just be, you know, like a very stereotypical, but she's like a very, like a pain person who has moments of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And the moments of clarity are the more painful parts.
May I call you Christine? Oh, I'm quite aware you come from a higher level of society. You probably made a debut, all that. I always considered Christine a gentle name. Hortense sounds fat. That's me, Hortense. My girl Hortense, they used to sing of me. Hasn't got much sense, let's write her name on the privy fence. Children can be nasty, don't you think?
That's why I think that acting is really so brave. Where she had to go in rehearsals, you know, I'm sure for the stage play to do this, would be extraordinary. She had to really go there. And then once you go there, you figure out where it lies in your body and you can repeat it. But first you have to go there and really deep. And she's done all that work for her to, like what you said, take these changes on a dime, you know, from 50 to 0 to 100 and then back down again. All of those, like, we talked about came from doing this performance and finding out where those moments were.
Yeah.
But so well studied. I mean, she just had to go to parts of herself that were so deep in order to find that. And she just breaks my heart in this. Breaks my heart.
Something that I love about this movie is her body language, because her body language in this is telling a story. Mm-hmm. And her body language is telling a story that Christine will then pick up, because you see,
you
can see this kind of transference of body language where, like, the way that, like, Daigle moves around the room, she's kind of like blowing in the wind a little bit, you know, and like she sits here and then she kind of moves over here. And there's a kind of quality where, like, her body isn't her own. And then all of a sudden, as things go wrong for Christine and she starts kind of unraveling, like that moment where Christine and Mrs. Daigle are together, and you realize that, like, one has become the other, you mm-hmm. know? Like, there's nothing separating them. They both lost their children in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I just love that kind of that change happens. Mm-hmm. She presents this body language that then Christine morphs into.
And look what we're discussing. In 1956, look at what strong roles for women are in this movie.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, really ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Because this could have been written quite differently. It could have been a male serial killer. It could have been a little boy. You know, there are so many things that it could have been. But yet it was so much more jarring because, and the husband, you know, Rhoda's dad and the husband was out of the picture pretty much for the majority of it. It was mm-hmm. really all of these, and even it was more about Mrs. Daigle than Mr. Daigle.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it all really centered around these three very powerful female characters in 1956. How great.
Yeah. And, you know, God, yeah, I'd wish for more of that today. And, you know, maybe let's talk about what actually is scary to us, something that you brought up earlier, too. A review of this film said, quote, "It's akin to being scared in a haunted house only for the mechanics to show you how it's done in the end."
Hmm.
Which they're saying it in a way that's praising, like, mm-hmm. how is this scary?
How is this scary?
What is it that scares us?
It's scary because we believe it. I think because they succeed in having us suspend our disbelief,
yeah.
and we are taken in and we believe in Rhoda.
Yeah.
And if you believe that Rhoda can exist, you're scared.
Yep.
You know, it's as simple as that. If you don't believe, if she's too over the top, if she is, if there's something that you don't accept about the premise, then it will not be scary.
I think so. Patty McCormick said, quote, "The character was presented to me as this little girl determined to get her own way rather than a ruthless murderer.
Right.
Yes, I knew she was a killer, but you never see her actually kill anyone on screen, which I think made the film even creepier.
Yes.
If remade today, it would almost certainly be more graphic, which I think would ruin its appeal."
I completely agree with that 100%.
Something that, you know, we mm-hmm. talked about today, which as a genre fan, mm-hmm. like I'm okay with kills on screen, mm-hmm. you know, like there's kind of a place for that, mm-hmm. but I don't think that it has to be in everything.
Yeah.
And I like when people think about what violence is mm-hmm. and try to circumvent how we show it and what it means and play with the psychology of that.
Well, I don't think that writers realize that they've shot themselves in the foot, because if you are so explicit with the violence, it tends to then not shock you anymore.
Yeah.
So you can't use it as a tool. So it's best in a way to not go there all the time, so that when you finally do go there, it makes a difference. I mean, in the same way that when Goodfellas first came out, you know, and every other word was fuck, and we were like, oh my God, I've never seen an entire thing. Now it is so commonly used. You've taken that word away now from the dictionary of things that can really compel or mm-hmm. shock, you know? So where are the next words that you're going to mm-hmm. use, you know? So I think that we all have to be careful with these things, because as we learn how to do them better, you know, with visual effects and special effects and make it more graphic and more real and more real, you're basically taking away all of your tools.
Okay, so I want to go back to Patty McCormick, because mm-hmm. she is, you know, such a lovely actor who
yes.
never repeated necessarily the quote-unquote success of this film with her roles, though mm-hmm. she absolutely just loved acting and continued to work. And, mm-hmm. you know, she said, quote, "Having been successful so young probably made my ambitions different to someone who yearns for that success throughout their career. I didn't become blindly ambitious for that success the rest of my life because I found it so early. So I've been happy taking the roles that I wanted because they were just enjoyable to play."
How mature, and how, because there are many child actors that don't go in that direction,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they hit their stride so early that they try to capture something that's bigger and better and more important. That's just so mature and so lovely to hear that from her.
Now, I'm not saying that you had like that success when you were 8, but when you graduated, you got success pretty early getting cast in a Broadway show.
Yes.
What does that do for you? What does that do for your psyche?
It scared the hell out of me. I mean, it was I was just in San Francisco in an open call, and I was one of three people taken from there. I was working as a receptionist at San Francisco Ballet and called in sick so I could go to the audition. And then
that's
they kept,
a good idea. Yeah.
And then kind of I kept making it down to the final cut. And finally, they had some news people there, and they showed me on the evening news auditioning. And so I get a call, and they tell me I was fired because I didn't.
They saw you on the evening news.
They saw me on the evening news, so they said I was fired. But then when I got hired the next day, they called back and wanted to do a huge story that would bring in San Francisco Ballet. Their receptionist just got this great role. In.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Yes, and it was written up. I can't go, oh, gosh, I'm blanking on the name of that wonderful writer who's no longer alive, Herb Kane, is that it, in San Francisco, who would do all these like little personality articles. And so it was written up in that. And, you know, and then 3 days later, I was on a plane to New York and starting a whole new life.
Did getting that success early have a positive or a negative effect?
Oh, completely positive, because it's so difficult. Just because you land on a stage in Broadway doesn't mean you can't be fired the next day. And suddenly you're working like crazy, and you just are praying that that you'll be worthy of what they've offered you, mm-hmm. you know? And plus this, I was an usher at the Schubert Theater in Los Angeles when Chorus Line first opened. It was my dream. And to suddenly step into what my dream was kind of crazy. It was kind of an out-of-body experience to have that gift so early on. But it shaped me forever.
And I have to say, I mean, bringing up Star Trek and, you know, being mm-hmm. a person who's iconic to mm-hmm. many fans in the same way that Patty McCormick as Rhoda is very iconic. You know, mm-hmm. there's so many people who know you as B'Elanna.
Yes.
And this is something that will be a part of your life forever. Like, what is that, you know, because, you know, she seems so grounded and, you know, she's totally fine. Yeah. She even like not reprised the role, but she did something like in a recent TV movie where she was in like the 2018 version of like the Bad Seed. Cause she's fans want me, whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, how does that affect you as a creator? Cause you're not just an actor.
Yeah.
You're also doing these other things.
I loved my character of B'Elanna. I mean, 7 years, I felt that the writers treated her really, really well. I loved who she was. And I'm still blown away when I get letters or people come up to me and say, I went into engineering because of you, or, you know, or I named my child after you. That's a little weird. But there are so many people who were touched. A lot of people who were torn either by being biracial.
I was going to say biracial.
Biracial, yeah. Or having different sides of them that were kind of at war with each other, that B'Elanna really was a character that they could turn to and see, well, how is she coping with this? You know, when does she succeed? When does she fail? I can learn from that. Mm-hmm. And so her character, which really had a lot of inner struggles, was great for people to, again, to start discussions, for people to really grow and learn and identify with. That was an entire era of my life, as Chorus Line was another era of my life, and I treasure them both. They couldn't be more different, but so, so wonderful. I'm so honored to be able to do that role.
Yeah, I hope you are, because people are going to keep naming their kids after you.
That was weird, definitely. They sent me the picture of the baby.
Was it a cute baby at least?
Yes, very cute.
Thank
very
God.
Cute baby.
Thank God. I want to thank you so much for coming and talking with us today about The Bad Seed.
Thank you.
And people can see Breakthrough how?
April 17th, it'll be released nationwide here. Mm-hmm. So just check your local listings. Go see it the first weekend, and it starts on Wednesday mm-hmm. for the full Easter week and weekend. And I am so proud of this. I really think that it's something that you can take away, and it'll offer up a lot of discussion afterwards. So I'm just really proud of it.
And the Apple show will be?
I'm not sure when that is coming on.
So just stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned for that. It's the morning show with, I think the name is going to be staying with Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, and Steve Carell. So look for that.
Wonderful.
And that's going to be wonderful, too.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Lucas M01 says, one of my favorite podcasts, without a doubt. April always invites the most interesting guests who always have so much insight to offer. This podcast might have completely changed the way I approach film, and I love it to death for that. So if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Oh, but I thought it was exciting. Can I have the peanut butter sandwich?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.